Imagine trying to start a multinational business and you're being told it's going to take 6 months, mandatory visits to seven different government ministries, and just a mountain of physical paperwork requiring dozens of ink stamps.
Yeah, and that's just to get your foot in the door, right?
Exactly. I mean, historically, for a foreign executive looking at emerging markets, that was just the baseline reality. You knew there was this incredible prize at the center of the market, but every single turn presented a new, invisible regulatory wall.
Right, you just expect opaque processes,
Yeah.
endless red tape, and honestly, a constant fear of stepping on some legal landmine you didn't even know existed.
Totally. But today we are looking at a market that has taken that entire 6 month ordeal and compressed it into like a 7 day digital window. We're talking about a market entry landscape that's been fundamentally re-engineered for speed.
It really is a complete paradigm shift in how cross-border capital is being treated. I mean, we're moving away from that era of defensive bureaucracy and entering this era of proactive digital facilitation.
Welcome to the deep dive. If you're joining us today, you are likely someone who needs to see the global board clearly. Whether you're an executive eyeing a market expansion, a consultant advising multinational clients, or just a deeply curious learner, understanding this shifting economic landscape is no longer optional for you.
Oh, absolutely not. You have to stay ahead of it.
Right. And today we are focusing squarely on India. We have a really comprehensive, professionally focused examination based on the Foreign Company Registration in India 2026, complete guide, which was authored by Chavi Gaur at K&M Management Advisory Services.
And I got to say, this specific guide is just essential reading for anyone in the corporate strategy space right now. It's a highly practical blueprint. It bridges the gap between those high-level macroeconomic trends and the actual nuts and bolts operational setup.
Yeah, and our mission today is to decode the specific legal, regulatory, and digital frameworks that are driving the massive 2025 and 2026 foreign direct investment surge in India. We want to give you a shortcut to being highly well-informed on this global business shift.
Because understanding the mechanics of how this works gives you a serious professional edge.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we even look at the operational steps of setting up a business, we have to look at the macroeconomic trigger. Like, why is so much capital flooding into this specific market right now?
Well, context is everything here. The data from our source is striking. The Economic Times reported a massive surge in India's foreign direct investment, or FDI, inflows throughout the 2025 financial year.
Wow. Okay. Was it across the board or just certain areas?
It wasn't randomly dispersed at all. It was highly concentrated in very strategic sectors, so manufacturing, renewable energy, and digital services. And you have industry heavyweights actively campaigning on this too.
Like who?
Well, PwC India launched their India's Investment Outlook 2026 report, and EY India is running this huge initiative called India's FDI Advantage. I mean, when the big four accounting firms are building dedicated infrastructure around market entry, it indicates that the demand from their corporate clients is just deafening.
Yeah, capital flows to where it's treated best, right? It sounds like India isn't just opening the door, they are actively rolling out a digital red carpet. But wait, is this just natural market growth? Or did something specific trigger this avalanche of capital?
What's fascinating here is that these aren't just isolated events. This surge is the direct result of a coordinated macroeconomic strategy. The government recognized that high-growth sectors need immediate regulatory stability to attract global boards of directors.
Okay, so what did they actually do?
Well, in the fourth quarter of 2025, the Department for Promotion of Industry and Internal Trade, the DPIT, issued a critical press note. And this document detailed sweeping relaxations in sector-specific FDI caps.
Let me pause you right there. When you say relaxing FDI caps, are we talking about giving foreign entities a minority stake, like maybe letting them own 49% of a local factory, or is the government actually letting them come in and own 100% of these operations outright?
In many of these strategic sectors, it's actually the latter. They are moving more industries to what they call the automatic route and allowing up to 100% foreign equity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're looking at high growth areas and essentially telling foreign investors, we will give you the complete operational control you need to make this capital expenditure worthwhile.
Okay, so the government has opened the floodgates and capital is just rushing in. But if I'm a foreign executive, I mean, I can't just wire millions of dollars into a void. I need a legal container to hold that money, hire people, and protect the parent company from liability.
Right, you need a vehicle.
Exactly. So what are the actual vehicles they're offering on this structural menu?
The guide lays out several very distinct options for 2026, and choosing the right one dictates your entire operational future. So let's start with the most robust option, the private limited company. This is the heavyweight vehicle.
Okay.
Under the automatic route in most sectors, a private limited company allows for that 100% foreign equity we just discussed.
Meaning a foreign parent company can own the whole thing outright, forming what the guide refers to as a wholly owned subsidiary.
Precisely. It gives the foreign parent full operational and commercial control over the Indian entity. To set this up, you only need a minimum of 2 directors and 2 shareholders.
And what about the capital requirement?
Interestingly, there is no statutory minimum capital requirement, which, you know, removes a pretty traditional barrier to entry. However, and this is a big however, with that full commercial freedom comes the absolute highest level of compliance.
There's the catch.
Yeah, you are subject to mandatory annual filings with the Registrar of Companies, and you must maintain audited financials. It requires a serious administrative apparatus.
That sounds like a massive commitment. What if, say, 2 multinational companies just want to partner on a specific infrastructure project without creating a rigid corporate board? I know the guide mentions the limited liability partnership, the LLP.
Yes, the LLP is an excellent alternative for that exact scenario. Foreign investment is generally permitted under the automatic route here as well, though you do have to verify specific sectoral restrictions under the FDI policy first.
Okay, so how does it differ structurally?
Well, instead of a formal board of directors, an LLP just needs 2 designated partners. And again, there's no statutory minimum capital.
And does it carry the same heavy compliance burden as the private limited company?
No, it's perceived as having a more moderate compliance footprint. You still have annual filing, sure, but the structural rigidity surrounding board meetings and formal corporate governance is definitely lessened. It's highly effective for professional services or temporary joint ventures where you really need that flexibility.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Let's do a hypothetical. Say I'm a foreign tech company. I have zero interest in selling products locally yet. I just want to put a team on the ground to do market research, understand the local consumer base, and maybe do some brand promotion. It sounds like setting up a full private limited company is overkill. I'd just use a liaison office like a scouting party, right?
You could, and that's actually why the government created the liaison office structure. Because if you tried to use a private limited company for that, you'd be crushed by the compliance requirements for absolutely zero financial return.
Right. I'd be paying for audited financials on a company that does nothing but spend money.
Exactly. So the liaison office is perfectly designed to be that scouting party. It acts purely as a communication channel between the parent company abroad and the Indian market. But, and any executive must understand this, a liaison office is strictly, unequivocally nonprofit.
So no commercial activity whatsoever, no invoicing, no trading.
None. You cannot generate a single rupee of local revenue. And because of this unique status, a liaison office doesn't just register with the Ministry of Corporate Affairs. It actually requires specific approval from the central bank, the Reserve Bank of India.
Wait, really? Why does the central bank care about a handful of marketing employees doing consumer research?
Because a liaison office, much like a branch office or a project office, is technically an extension of the foreign parent company. It is not a separate Indian legal entity.
Ah.
Yeah, so the central bank monitors them closely because these structures involve funds moving across borders purely to sustain local operations without any domestic revenue generation to offset it. It is entirely an issue of foreign exchange management. They need to track the capital flight and inflow.
Okay, that clarifies the regulatory logic beautifully. If I actually do want to generate local revenue without incorporating a whole new Indian subsidiary, I assume that's where the branch office or project office comes into play.
Spot on. A branch office is permitted to carry out specific central bank approved commercial activities. Think export and import trading, professional consultancy, or IT services. Crucially, the profits generated by a branch office are repatriable back to the foreign parent.
And the project office?
A project office is a similar extension, but it's established for executing very specific finite contracts, usually in heavy infrastructure or manufacturing. Both of these typically require Reserve Bank approval, though certain internationally funded projects might get an automatic green light.
All right, so we have our frustrable menu. A business leader has weighed the compliance of a PVT LTD against the limitations of a branch office, and they have picked their vehicle. The next problem is execution.
Right, the actual setup.
Exactly. How do we transition from this legal theory to the actual on-the-ground reality in 2026? We talked about avoiding a 6-month bureaucratic nightmare earlier. How painful is the modern setup?
Well, the guide highlights a huge wave of digital reforms from the Ministry of Corporate Affairs that landed in the third quarter of 2025. They completely overhauled the mechanics, replacing those old sequential paper-based approvals with a parallel digital system.
So what's the actual process look like now?
Let's walk through the four-step process. Step one is the mandatory digital application for your digital signature certificate and your director identification number. This is basically the cryptographic proof of identity for the individuals running the company.
Okay, pretty standard. Step two is the RUN form, right? RUN, standing for Reserve Unique Name. That seems straightforward, just checking a database to ensure your proposed corporate name doesn't infringe on existing trademarks.
Yep, very quick.
But step three is what really caught my attention in the source material. The SPICE Plus Form Part B, SPICE Plus. When I first read about it, I kind of assumed it was just a glorified online PDF.
Oh, no. It is far more than a PDF. It's an integrated digital pipeline that talks to multiple different government ministries simultaneously. In the past, achieving interdepartmental cooperation was the absolute biggest bottleneck for foreign investors. You would get your corporate registration, then take those physical papers to the tax department, wait weeks, then take those papers to the Labor Department. It was brutal.
And I'm guessing the SPICE Plus form eliminates that sequential waiting.
Entirely. The single integrated form handles the foundational incorporation, but it also reaches into the tax pipelines. It generates your permanent account number for corporate income taxes and your tax deduction number.
And it does labor stuff too, right?
Yes. At the exact same time, it wires your new company into the National Employee Provident Fund and the state insurance networks.
It also handles the registration for the goods and services tax, the indirect tax system, and triggers the opening of your corporate bank account. I mean, it sounds like the ultimate bureaucratic combo meal or like TSA pre-check for corporate registration. It takes an alphabet soup of six or seven different major administrative hurdles and solves them with one single application.
That is exactly what it does. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the impact of this API-driven approach really cannot be overstated. According to the 2026 guide, because of these Q3 2025 updates, the total registration time has been collapsed down to just 7 to 15 working days.
That is insane.
I know. Assuming your initial documentation is perfectly accurate, of course, it completely removes the friction of entry for emerging markets.
Under 2 weeks to spin up a fully compliant corporate entity complete with tax and labor integrations in a market of that scale. So the digital setup is essentially an accelerator pedal. But the guide also mentions a very specific physical requirement in step four, the post-incorporation compliance.
Right, the resident director.
Yeah, you must have a registered physical office address, and for a private limited company, at least one of your minimum two directors must be a resident of India.
You cannot just exist in the cloud. You need a physical footprint.
But why is the resident director so strictly enforced? Like, if a European conglomerate is fronting 100% of the capital and running the operations digitally, why do they have to find someone living in India to sit on the board?
Well, think of the digital setup as the accelerator and the resident director as the local emergency brake.
Okay, interesting.
Historically, governments in emerging markets faced situations where completely foreign-owned entities would rack up local debts or compliance failures, and then the foreign directors would simply abandon the subsidiary and vanish across borders.
Leaving the government holding the bag.
Exactly. The local government had no legal jurisdiction to hold anyone accountable. So by mandating an Indian resident director, the regulatory bodies ensure there is a permanent legal point of contact on the ground.
It prevents those fly-by-night operations.
Precisely. It balances the rapid, frictionless digital entry with real-world legal responsibility.
Okay, so the company is registered, the physical office is leased, and the local director is in place. The operation is live. The final piece of the puzzle for any professional is understanding how the money works.
The financial reality.
Right. We need to talk about approvals, taxation, and most importantly, getting the profits back home to the parent company.
The life cycle of the capital. So we briefly touched on how the money gets in. The guide clearly demarcates the two main FDI routes. First is the automatic route, where your investment flows in without needing prior government permission, provided you inform the central bank shortly after.
And the other is the government approval route.
Correct. Under that route, you must secure permission from the relevant national ministry before you can invest a single dollar. That's usually reserved for sensitive sectors like defense or specific telecommunications.
Right. Makes sense. But once the capital is deployed and the subsidiary is hopefully generating a profit, the tax implications become the real priority. The source material emphasizes the critical need to master both corporate income tax and the goods and services tax.
And this is where strategic financial planning really separates successful expansions from costly failures. You aren't just dealing with a local tax code, you are navigating the intersection of two sovereign nations' tax authorities.
So, what does this all mean for the bottom line? With all these acronyms, FEMA, DTAA, GST, is the compliance burden quietly eating away at the profits? If I'm advising a client, their immediate fear is going to be profit erosion.
Oh, absolutely.
They will ask, am I going to pay a 25% corporate tax in India? And then when I wire the remaining profits back to the United States or Europe, is my home country's tax authority going to tax that exact same money again? Are they just bleeding out margins at the border?
That is the most valid fear for any foreign board. And it's the exact problem that double taxation avoidance agreements, or DTAAs, are designed to solve. The guide highlights how crucial these treaties are for maintaining commercial viability.
Walk me through the actual mechanism of a DTAA. How does it act as a shield for those profits?
Let's use a tangible scenario. Let's say your Indian subsidiary makes $1 million in profit. Without a DTAA, you pay India's corporate tax, let's just call it $250,000.
Okay.
Then you wire the remaining $750,000 back to your headquarters in the U.S. The IRS then looks at that incoming revenue and taxes it again according to U.S. corporate rates.
Your margins are decimated.
Exactly. So a DTAA is a bilateral treaty where the two countries agree on who gets to tax what. Under most of these agreements, the U.S. would look at that $750,000 and say, we see you already paid $250,000 to the Indian government. We will grant you a tax credit for that exact amount against whatever you owe us.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah, and in other treaty structures, the income might simply be completely exempt in the home country.
It essentially synchronizes the two tax systems, so the corporation is only paying the maximum rate of one country rather than compounding them.
Right. It actively protects the bottom line.
But assuming the DTAA protects the margins, how difficult is the actual physical transfer of that profit back to the parent company?
Profit repatriation is generally permitted, but it is strictly governed by FEMA, the Foreign Exchange Management Act.
Right, so it's not a free-for-all.
Definitely not. You cannot just open an app and wire millions of dollars across borders. The central bank requires a meticulous paper trail, proving that all applicable corporate taxes have been paid, all statutory filings are up to date, and the company is actually operating within its approved sector limits.
They want to ensure capital isn't fleeing the country before tax obligations are settled.
Exactly. And, you know, it's worth noting the guide doesn't paint a purely utopian picture either.
Right. It explicitly notes that while the digital setup is incredibly fast, operational challenges remain. Regulatory complexities surrounding labor laws and state-specific compliance are still hurdles, especially for companies that try to navigate the market without expert local legal counsel.
Yeah, there's also the reality of cultural integration within the workforce and industry-specific supply chain nuances.
Which reinforces why the initial structural choice like private limited company versus branch office versus liaison office is so critical. Your legal vehicle dictates your level of exposure to those downstream operational complexities.
I mean, it really does. You have to get the foundation right.
Well, today we've traced the mechanics of the 2025 and 2026 FDI surge in India right down to the operational roots. We've looked at how a professional must choose between the robust 100% equity control of a private limited company, the flexible partnerships of an LLP, or the strict nonprofit scouting capabilities of a liaison office.
And we unpacked how the digital reforms, specifically that interdepartmental API of the Spice Plus form, have collapsed incorporation timelines from months down to a 7-day window.
We also clarified the financial safeguards, detailing how double taxation avoidance agreements prevent border taxation from destroying profit margins, and how the resident director requirement serves as a necessary anchor for accountability.
It's a lot of moving parts, but they all serve a purpose.
For you listening, having this structural knowledge puts you significantly ahead of the curve. You aren't just reacting to headlines about global market shifts. You actually understand the underlying legal and digital mechanisms making those shifts possible.
The regulatory landscape, however, is not static. And this raises an important question based on a final forward-looking detail in the source material.
Oh, what's that?
The guide references a late 2025 report from LiveMint regarding the Indian government discussing a true single-window clearance mechanism. They are actually anticipating state-level pilot programs in early 2026.
Wait, a system even faster and more integrated than the Spice Plus form we just discussed?
Precisely. While Spice Plus integrates federal incorporation and national taxes, this new single window would attempt to unify every single local, municipal, state, and federal approval, from environmental clearances right down to local fire safety permits, into one unified digital interface.
That would be wild.
It would be. And if a market of this staggering size and complexity successfully pilots a true all-encompassing single window system, effectively eliminating the final frictions of cross-border expansion, will this become the new mandatory baseline for any sovereign nation looking to attract global capital in the late 2020s?
That's the real question, right? If one massive economy proves you can clear the bureaucratic maze, that cleanly multinational investors simply won't tolerate stumbling in the dark anywhere else.
They will expect the floodlights to be turned on globally.
It's a fascinating thought to mull over as we watch these 2026 pilot programs roll out. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep analyzing the data, and keep questioning the changing shape of global business. We'll catch you on the next one.